This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is Penny Lane, the acclaimed documentary filmmaker whose previous works include Listening to Kenny G and Hail Satan, both of which form the basis of previous Reason interviews that are linked to in the show notes. Her exceptional new film is Confessions of a Good Samaritan. It's currently streaming at Netflix, and it follows her experience as what's called an altruistic kidney donor, or one who gives an organ away to an anonymous stranger. We talk about how she came to make her decision, its effects on her body, mind, and finances, and the ethics of current policy, which prevents donors from being paid for giving away life-saving organs. My instinct as more or less a libertarian is, yeah, pay people, she tells me. It seems like a really obvious thing. But it's not a simple one either, she explains, both because of current laws and medical history. We also talk about the state of documentary filmmaking, if we're in a golden age for the genre, and whether audiences are becoming smarter consumers of media. Here is the Reason interview with Penny Lane.
What I'm doing next week is called an altruistic donation, which just means I'm giving a kidney to someone I don't know. Some people call it anonymous donation or non-directed donation, Good Samaritan donation, which is my least favorite term for it. I don't know, it just makes me uncomfortable. It's like Jesus stuff or something.
So part of God's story is about a Good Samaritan, and it goes like this.
Anyway, whatever you call it, it's super rare. Of the population of living donors, you know, the vast majority are between loved ones or at least acquaintances. It's only about 2% of living donations that go to strangers. So it's kind of a weird thing to do.
Penny Lane, thanks for talking to Reason.
I'm happy to be here.
The new movie is Confessions of a Good Samaritan. It is playing on Netflix. This is a movie about your decision to give a kidney to a stranger.
Correct.
And I've also read that this is the first movie about organ donation pretty much at all, but particularly about the type of organ donation you did. Can you talk a little bit about why, you know, deciding to give a kidney to a stranger is rare?
So the type of donation that I did is known as an altruistic donation. Some people call it non-directed donation or Good Samaritan donation. And the idea is that it's going to kind of whoever needs it. The gift is anonymous. So I don't know who received it and I never will. It's a pretty rare practice in the United States. There's a few hundred people a year who do this. But that's a huge increase from 20 years ago when there were zero people who did this.
And you're one and out, right? I mean, you give one kidney and you're done.
Yeah, you can only do it once.
Yeah, okay. Although I guess you could die.
When you're dead, you could give away the other one.
So let's start by talking about, you know, your decision-making process, mm-hmm. because this is a personal documentary, which is different than your previous work, and we'll get to that in a bit. But, you know, why did you decide to do this?
Well, there was the donation itself, which, you know, as I say in the film, and as you would hear from most altruistic donors, kind of just seemed like an obviously good idea. The amount of sort of risk and suffering that the donor is likely to take on statistically is just nothing compared to the good that you're doing for another person who's literally dying.
But did you have a moment where, I mean...
I heard about it on a podcast, okay. To be honest. You hear about the idea that you can do it, which, right. You know, before you hear about it, you don't know. And so I think I just instantly kind of instinctively knew I wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you generally speaking utilitarian in your...
Yeah.
Are you trying to maximize the good that you do in the world or that gets done in the world?
I feel like I used to be a lot more, but the effective altruism movement was a very big influence on my life. Maybe about 10, 15 years ago, you know, it really impacted the way that I wanted to be in the world. So I do think there was a certain ground that had been laid by those ideas that made me maybe more receptive to the idea that the suffering of a distant stranger might matter as much as someone closer to me,
Or, isn't it? It's kind of weird. I'm thinking the effect of altruists I know, or people who are kind of broadly in that camp, tend to be very scientific and they're into evolution. And whenever you talk to an evolutionist, they're always like, well, you know, we don't care about distant strangers as much as we care about our kin. And in a lot of ways, my response to that is always like, well, the last people I would give kidneys to are my family. But so how does that work? I mean, like you just, you were thinking in these terms and then it got into your head and you're like, okay, I'm going to go do this.
Yeah. So I just did it. I mean, I called up a transplant center and said, hello, I'd like to give you my kidney. And they actually didn't call back at first.
Who the fuck is this? What kind of prank is this?
I had to call a second time. But I eventually got through them and just made it happen. And they figured out someone from their patient pool that was a good match for me. And then
obviously the documentary shows a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is amazing to me is the way that you foreground, okay, it's easy kind of intellectually to make this decision.
Yes.
And then as you're getting closer and like you're chopping vegetables and you're doing pretty well. But I mean, at what point were you like, wow, this maybe was not a great idea?
I would say there were many things along the way that made me feel that way, to be honest. One thing that isn't in the film but was a big part of why this was kind of a miserable experience for me is that the surgery date kept getting pushed back for, I'm sure, quite legitimate reasons.
And that's because of the donor, the
recipient.
Yeah,
something I don't know about, but like it just kept getting pushed back. And I am a freelancer. And so I was passing on jobs and then, you know, not having the surgery and then just being unemployed and another month would go by. And so I lost a lot more money than I thought I would. That was the first kind of round of things that made me feel pretty stupid. And that's not in the film because it didn't test well with audiences. They didn't like hearing me complain about losing money.
Yeah.
But I did lose a lot of money. And the average donor in the United States loses about $4,000 in, you know, lost wages.
And that's just in direct lost wages.
Yeah, lost wages, child care, you know.
How long is the recovery period?
The recovery period is not very long in, like, big picture terms, like it's a few days, you're in the hospital for a day and you go home and you're kind of up and about within a week, you're sore. But I do think on another level, and this is in the film, there's I think your body is healing for a good long time.
And you also got depressed afterwards.
Yeah, and
right?
I got pretty depressed afterwards. Partly, I'm assuming it was like a big letdown after this very intense event. And also, I think my body was just recovering and I was just like low energy levels for probably 6 months after
How
the surgery.
How psychologically, I mean, what can you describe that? You know, because this is like, I mean, you know, it can't be underestimated. Like this is a life-giving exchange, but then you don't really get the gratitude that would kind of help put it in perspective or make you feel better and more motivated.
Right.
About it.
Or even like know who the person is you're saving and like be able to picture them in your head and like put a value on that.
Which
it's
might
all
also
very
be
abstract.
Good if they turned out to be like, you know,
a jerk.
I mean, if it ends up being Harvey Weinstein or something, right? You're like,
I'd like to believe I'd still feel good about it, even if it were Harvey Weinstein. But yes, I didn't.
Well, then he could serve his time.
I didn't.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I made it easy for myself in a way because I didn't have to think about that relationship or if I would like them or not. But I made it very hard for myself in the other way where, yes, it felt very abstract. You know, the idea of being a good Samaritan means that you're putting the needs of a stranger above your own, like at least for some, you know, moment in time. And anyone who ever said that was easy just hasn't tried it, is my guess, because it's very hard. All of your psychology is telling you that you are the most important person in the universe. So trying to override that it's almost impossible.
Did you have, did you snap out of it or, you know, did you, like, how did you get over, you know, kind of feeling blue afterwards?
I didn't. The pandemic happened and then it got worse. Truthfully. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it just takes time. It's been 5 years since my surgery, so it's kind of hard to say now, like, when do I think the turn was, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
If there was a turn, I don't know. Maybe I'm still depressed. I don't know. I can't tell.
How complicated is the, you know, among other things, the fact that in the movie where you're dealing with your anxiety and you're kind of you know, second thoughts and things like that. You show footage of yourself recovering from surgery, which is, you know, pretty bold as a filmmaker, but it, you know, how painful was it on a physical level? Like, you know, the doctors say on a scale of 1 to 10.
There was almost no pain because we have really good painkillers now. So it wasn't, and I think that was part of what I was so afraid of, was that I'd be in this like horrible pain.
Yeah.
But no, it wasn't that I was like in so much pain. I was just exhausted and, you know, I was sore and stiff and it was hard to move around. And it was hard to ask for help. You know,
why is that you individually or is it people in general?
I feel like it's people
you're a
in
giver.
General.
You don't want to. I mean, like I'm the altruist.
I don't even feel like I'm a giver. Well, that is part of it, right? Like that was part of it was that I was trying to like. I think the main thing that was hard for me was really psychological because I was trying so hard to not complain and to not care about my actually very insignificant problems in the face of the world, and I was trying to just keep the welfare of this distant stranger at the top of mind, and my failure to be able to do that became an inordinate amount of shame because I thought I just wasn't doing it right. And that's really the conflict you see in the film is I'm trying so hard to like be a perfect altruist and just failing because no one is actually. Like there are no saints in real life.
Now, and that Good Samaritan, he was on, you know, in the Bible, he was probably on the way to a whorehouse or something.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah. We actually know nothing about the Good Samaritan. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Other than that he
could have been a crappy person
out.
In every way. But yeah, did this good deed once. And we are meant to model ourselves on that, which is beautiful. But as Jacob Appel, my bioethicist, says in the film, the problem with the parable of the Good Samaritan as a moral framework is that there are infinite roads and infinite number of people lying on the side of them in need of help. And so it doesn't provide you with some kind of great, you know, overarching framework for how to organize your life. So it's just sort of an impulse or an idea. And I think that I was so, I was just very moved by it ultimately.
Are you done with altruism now? Or
I punched my card.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I got
a lot
of points for this.
Yeah,
so.
you know, this is like you can take the next 10 years off or something.
I think probably could.
Has it changed your attitude towards things like effective altruism or that type of thing?
I don't think so. I do think that, you know, earlier when you said, am I like a utilitarian, I think I would say that I am very attracted to thinking in that way. I do think it's good to sort of provoke yourself by asking certain questions about like, is this thing I'm doing that's meant to help people actually helping people or is it just making you feel good? These are very important questions to ask.
And you mentioned Jacob Appel, who's a figure in the documentary, is a great person to kind of have those conversations with.
Yeah, exactly. But over time, I think and it was during the course of making the film, really, I just came to understand that also isn't a complete moral system. If you're a mother, you absolutely should love your child way more than someone else's child. Like that's your basic job. So like I just started to think about the fact that there are two things really. One, that it is important to care for the people who actually love you and to be a good friend, and all those things are very valuable and important. And two, that the topic of organ donation, it doesn't map perfectly onto the sort of money. It's not like it's money. Like it's not like giving 10% of your income away. It's a part of your body. And I think that I didn't early on really grok how different it is. It's a very intimate experience. It's as intimate as like childbirth. So the idea that you would feel morally compelled to give a kidney away actually disgusts me in a way.
Yeah, but
like you shouldn't feel like compelled to do it.
But
that would
you
be
kind
bad.
Of started out kind of feeling that way. Like, look, the math checks out.
Yeah,
perfect.
Why isn't everyone doing
Everybody
this?
Everybody should
yeah,
be doing
exactly.
That. And you talk to one of the experts. I'm forgetting her name.
Abigail Marsh.
Yeah, who talked to you at one point said like, you know, or it comes up like, why hasn't she given a kidney. And her answer is kind of she's freaked out by the surgery.
Yeah, which is probably why most people don't do it.
Yeah. And you, I mean, part of what is great about the movie, I mean, is that you move from that position of kind of, you know, apodictic certainty to like, yeah, you know what, like, I'm glad I did it, but I wouldn't force this on people.
Exactly. And just to be clear for your audience, like, we're the film is very much about these conflicts, but like, just to be super clear, it was a great thing that I did.
Yeah.
I'm inordinately proud of it. I feel immense satisfaction. I'm glad I did it. That all is true in the end, but it just wasn't an easy, it was very hard. I think it was a lot harder than I thought it would be. So yeah, there's a kind of structure in the film that goes from like kind of a voice of innocence to a voice of wisdom.
Right.
And that innocent voice is a little naive. And that wise voice is a little more jaded and just sees things a bit more complicated.
What you also talked to Sally Satel, who not only is somebody who I've interviewed a number of times over the years, and you know, I consider her a friend, but also received a kidney when she needed it most from a former editor of Reason Magazine, Virginia Postrel. Let's talk a little bit about kidney donation policy. Mm-hmm. How much of the dearth of available kidneys is because we don't compensate donors meaningfully?
I think the answer is we don't know because we've never tried it. But I would say that, you know, the real problem is that we are obese and just have a lot of kidney disease. I mean, just to put it in very basic terms, there is a crisis, a health crisis, where more and more people end up in need of kidneys. And that is only getting worse. So the need for kidneys, it comes mainly from that. Of course, there are people who are born with certain defects or, you know, and there is a need that's there.
Does it matter? Should we draw a distinction between people who need kidneys because they just rolled the genetic lottery and lost, and people who went to Golden Corral too often?
I mean, do you think we should?
I don't know. I don't know. And I always think about this because I mentioned Golden Corral, the buffet restaurant that is famous for, you know, it has a chocolate fountain, a butterscotch fountain, a caramel fountain.
Sounds
a
great.
A marshmallow fountain. And where I lived in Ohio, I used to take my kids there. And it was horrifying because most of the people who ate there, I mean, they would like, you know, their motor scooters, their rascal scooters would, you know, get crash in front of the dessert bar. And then one day it was closed and a DaVita dialysis place.
Wow.
It opened up.
What an image.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, do they own Golden Corral? Are they? But, you know, there is a growing problem, right? Where
there
we're
is.
Living
yeah.
longer,
yeah.
we eat more junk food, all of that kind of stuff. But like, I don't think so, really.
I don't think there's a moral difference. Yeah.
Yeah. I would be curious, like from a utilitarian point of view, and I'm sure people have thought this through, like, do you give younger people kidney, or, you know, do you give them rare organs because they have more life ahead of them? Do you give successful people more, you know, because like if you can save Einstein with a kidney, isn't that better than saving, you know, Joe Bag of Donuts? I don't know.
Well, the thing is that there's so many problems in this world of, so it's like its own topic that we would need hours to get into, but I would just say, very successful people really don't have a problem getting organs because they tend to be in healthier circles. They have more people that are willing to help them, that are healthy enough to help them. So we have this horrible problem where most of the people who need kidneys are least likely to have someone in their life who's even healthy enough to give them a kidney.
Yeah.
So my transplant surgeon in the film, Dr. Melanson, tells a story about one of his patients who needed a kidney, and he had five friends come forward to say they would do it for him. And he had to call all five of them to say, no, you all have kidney disease. And in fact, one of these fives already needs a kidney himself. So the reality is demographically, you know, head of the company is going to be fine, but that's not who's, So it's a huge, it's so many problems.
Yeah.
There's so many problems with
it. So would clear compensation make the situation, it might not solve it, but it would definitely make it better.
I think it probably would, you know, and then it just, so my instinct as like, you know, a more or less libertarian, more or less utilitarian, I'm just kind of like, yeah, pay people.
Yeah.
It seems like a really obvious thing. I do think there would be so many knock-on effects that it's just worth thinking through. We don't know because we haven't done the experiment, and we should. But for example, if we started this is just an argument that I think is at least worth considering. If we did start paying people for organs, would the act go from being this beautiful, you know, admirable act that people feel good about doing, like giving blood, and turn into something that people would feel shame about, because to do right. it would be to announce
so
that you're
poor.
So it
would be like selling plasma
right.
for...
I mean, I'm not saying that would happen, but it right. feels reasonable to assume that mm-hmm. that it would change the idea of it in a way that might have some pretty negative effects. So there's good arguments and there's dumb arguments. The dumb arguments are like, you know, it's exploitative or something. Yeah. That makes me nuts. Right. There's no point in arguing
and
about
also
that.
That there's a clear alternative because
right.
all of the ideas of what will just make everybody donors, you know, so when they die in a car crash or at, a nurse or funeral homes, mm-hmm. we'll just harvest stuff, right?
Right, which by the way, like people feel pretty grossed out by and don't love, and you end up hearing endless creepy stories about like families who feel like they were pressured to like give organs of their loved ones. I mean, again, I don't think that's a reason not to do it, but it's hardly like then you have clean hands ethically just by making it after you die or something.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of transplantation? Because one, and this was something that I've been in various situations where I've been adjacent to transplantation or organ donation, but this was something I hadn't encountered before, and it was fascinating. The history and the kind of bioethics involved in, like, how did we get to a point where we knew you could transplant kidneys? And, like, you have incredible footage and stories to tell about the early recipients and donors of kidneys.
So, obviously, organ transplantation was a dream of doctors for millennia. You know, they were trying. They'd always try.
And
they
the occasional serial killer, right, or whatever, right?
But it never worked, you know, and now we know that it was because of the immune system. And so it took, you know, the surgical techniques were perfected maybe as early as the early 1900s. People could, like, figure out how to connect the blood vessels, but they would always reject the organs.
Right. Which is like, amazing.
It's amazing.
To think about
like, how you connect blood vessels, like with like a needle and thread. it's remarkable, but it just kept failing. And so eventually we had to make some – the early people who had successful transplants were identical twins because they were close enough genetically that it wouldn't reject.
Yeah, I mean, which is –
amazing.
Kind of amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Like it's miraculous.
Yeah. The newsreel footage and stuff is like phenomenal.
Yeah. The first successful identical twin surgery was basically like on Christmas Day in Boston. Like, can you imagine?
Yeah. And it's like finding identical twins.
Yeah.
One of whom needs a kidney.
And the other one
has
happy
two,
to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And wanted to do it. And the important thing is that that was incredibly controversial.
Yeah.
You know, even in a case where we had a pretty good idea that it would probably work, it still hadn't been done before.
Right.
So it could have not worked. And the doctors were like, and the ethicists were sort of appalled by it. Should you allow someone to take on all this risk to save their twin? And they basically all were like, no. You know, so what you see in the film is this evolution from that, which is the 50s, 60s, I think, to now, where if we had the same situation, we would probably think kind of poorly of a twin who wouldn't be willing to do it. So it's really a huge change. And then so what you see throughout the history of organ transplantation is this kind of boundary of what's possible moving forward and the same ethical questions asked at each stage. So my question, and this isn't a question I can answer yet or maybe ever, is there a line there with the strangers? Like, would we ever think, well, of course you owe your kidney to a stranger who's not healthy. Like, on some level, it seems possible because if you look at that line, it kept going in that direction. But I kind of wonder. I think there might be something about the stranger idea that is a bridge too far for the average person or for most people to accept. It's very controversial. What I did is controversial in some circles still. And even 10, 20 years ago, most transplant centers wouldn't do it. They just wouldn't do it. They would not do a stranger-to-stranger transplant because they thought it was too ethically creepy.
Is there the dream is always that there will be a technological fix. And, you know, there are stories about organs being grown in pigs or in other, you know, I guess we already use pig insulin, right? Pig-derived or whatever. Or we'll 3D print artificial organs and things like that. How realistic is that?
So at the very same transplant center where I gave my kidney, about 2 years later, they had the first series of successful CRISPR pig kidney transplants. So pigs that have been genetically modified to be more accepted by humans. And there, it's, it seems like it's working pretty well. As an animal rights advocate, I hasten to add that is not really a technological solution. I don't know. I kind of think the pigs matter and that they're not machines meant, you know.
Do the pigs die in that process?
No one's ever said, and I think it's telling that no one's even asked that of these people, because just as an aside, you might wonder, why aren't we using monkeys? Wouldn't monkeys be genetically closer? And the answer is, decades of PETA activism has taught us that monkeys shouldn't be treated that way.
Right.
And they look too much like us, and it freaks us out. So instead, we use pigs because pigs are already raised as food, so we don't have the same. We don't think they matter the same amount.
Do you think, like, if it becomes a choice between pigs, pigs who cannot consent, can solve this problem, you would be like, no, we got to figure out how to talk to the pigs first?
I think that, and I actually mean this, we should treat the pigs as heroes and give them beautiful lives. Like, you know, like once they've donated their kidney, let them go live out a beautiful, happy pig life. I don't think that's on the table, Nick, but I do think that would be ethically okay.
And then there is the idea, you know, you get into this with discussions about vat-grown meat, that maybe eventually we culture something from a, a pig, or I guess if we can do that, we probably can do it from human kidneys.
Right, and just then, grow them out of cells
and
then
suddenly we, you know, that provenance, the ethical questions kind of disappear.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll disappear. I suppose there'll be other ones. I think that organ transplant is sticky and fraught, and it's never going to not be. Even if we have a technological solution, we have a technological solution now. It's called transplantation.
Right.
People are still squicked out by it. So there's something, again, about the body, the boundary of the body that is not the same as donating hours at a charity or giving money to a charity. It's just a different thing.
Do you root any of this in arguments about bodily autonomy? So you were saying, okay, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, stranger donations, not so good, but like you own your body and you should be able to give away your organs, right?
I think so, yeah. One of the interesting interludes in the film, which is part of the history I didn't know that I learned from Sally Satel, was in the early 80s when Congress was trying to figure out what to do about the what then was called, which is suddenly we had something called an organ crisis, just because transplantation got good enough that it could work. Therefore, there's an organ crisis. It's quite strange if you think about it. There was no organ crisis until we had transplant. But now we have this crisis and, like, what are we going to do? And so, you know, our brilliant federal government got together to figure it out. And Al Gore was the head of it. And, you know, he was really grossed out by the idea of compensation. And many people were also, but not everybody. So they had this series of hearings. And there was a guy named Dr. Barry Jacobs who came to sort of fight for this idea of just compensation, like straight compensation. Like, someone wants to give an organ, let's pay them.
And of course, my libertarian bona fides are showing he's one of the heroes, along with you, he's the hero of the movie in a lot of ways. Because it's just straightforward.
Like, yes.
This makes everything easier.
But he had a certain, let's say, affect that I don't think was very appealing to people. And so he just, if there had been a different person who came and argued for it, who didn't gross people out, maybe had like less of a weird comb over or something, maybe people would have been into it, but they just didn't, it didn't, he didn't win the argument. And so we decided at that point as a nation that we would only have altruistic donation. And then once you've got that law, pretty hard to change
it. It's also interesting in those scenes, you know, and I was thinking, I don't think about Al Gore that much anymore. I think that's kind of common, but how Christian he was, and that in a way, and I'm not saying anything bad about Christianity, but it's, you know, that there was a religious dimension to the debate, which might not be as loud now because we're a much more secular country.
It's possible.
You know, it seemed, and then you get into that question of not just bodily autonomy, but also like what is sacred versus profane.
Correct. Which, and what feels disgusting to people.
Yeah. And there was a bioethicist who's, I think, might still be around, and he was Bush's bioethics czar, but he talked a lot, Leon Cass,
yes,
who talked about the wisdom of repugnance.
Correct.
And whenever I hear that, You know, and I believe in emotion, but it was like the wisdom of repugnance that has been used to validate all kinds of things that we cannot broach right. anymore, like, right. you know, interracial marriage.
Right. It's,
or
the, it's
whatever.
An idea I mean, that came like, from like the biological imperative not to eat rotten meat that smells bad.
Yeah.
Like that's
yeah.
what that is.
Yeah.
You know? Yes, the wisdom of repugnance makes sense when you like smell the milk yeah. and it's gross and you should probably shouldn't drink it.
Right.
But I agree that it's not a great.
You should inject it.
Not a great like overarching moral framework, but I do think that it's worth just saying, you know, when I was working on this film that I read Jonathan Haidt's book about the moral foundations theory,
yeah.
and it helped me think about this a bit more because just mm-hmm. because my levels of kind of, you know,
of
purity
disgust,
and disgust right, are yeah. like sort of over there and attenuated yeah. and I don't think about them much doesn't mean it's not important for a lot of people.
Right.
So I want to own that and honor that. So if you're – but it's kind of like moot because if you're disgusted by the idea of giving a kidney or receiving one, you won't do it. So it's pretty like
yeah.
you can just rule yourself out.
Yeah. And like you don't
you
have
get permission to.
To
go not do
yeah,
it. Yeah.
yeah. Is there any policy change on any of this? Because what's happening in the U.S. is also a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I mean, globally, we have a very thriving black market, but that's, again, another topic. In the U.S., there has been some movement recently to do exactly what Sally Satel was advocating in the film, which is to do a pilot program mm-hmm. where we do I think it's a $50,000 tax credit, but spread out over 10 years.
Right.
And to see what does that do. And I think that's – I think it's – I don't remember if it got passed in the Congress or if it's in the Congress now. But I think there's some good movement on that.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think it's an obvious idea.
Right.
I mean, you know, you don't have to go to markets. You don't have to say, like, let's just let people
yeah.
buy and sell them. The federal government
Although
is bankrupt.
Although I have an app that I'm
yeah.
ready to launch the minute
I know.
That happens. Right?
Well, right. the federal government is already bankrupting itself on dialysis for life for an increasing population that is sick and dying anyway.
And it's also – and you – I mean, the documentary gets us across the reality of dialysis. It's
yeah.
not like, oh, I'm going to go plug myself in for a couple hours and then I'll feel tip top. It is a gray existence at best when you get to the
yeah.
late stages of kidney disease.
It's pretty tough. And if you're on dialysis for too long, you just end up too sick to get a
yeah.
transplant. So and it's its own miracle cure, like
yeah,
in a way.
Absolutely.
Like incredible. Great
yeah.
story behind that. That's not in the film. But that said, it is not the best solution.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about documentaries. You know, this, you know, what are your, this documentary is very different than your previous work, some of which we've talked about at Reason. You and I talked about Listening to Kenny G, which is, you know, a masterpiece. And then you talked with Todd Cranen, a former Reason TV guy, about Hail Satan, which remains as relevant as ever in many ways. How difficult was it to go from a documentary where you are behind the camera and sometimes one hears your voice
sure.
lobbing a question, but you're definitely not
the main character.
Yeah, and to something like this.
I mean, you know, the short answer is horrible. It was horrible. I hated
yeah.
it. It was really hard. And I realized how much I'm bringing, how much usually I'm able to craft a character.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I met Kenny or when I was doing the Satanic Temple piece, I kind of understood like which aspects of this person's life and personality are relevant to this particular story that I'm telling.
Yeah.
And this was hard. I was like, all of it? I mean, it's
yeah.
hard when it's you. You're like, all of it?
Yeah.
You know, so I had to really rely on my editors to help me craft that character
because mm-hmm.
I had no perspective on Penny in the movie. So
could you talk a little when you say character?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, and mm-hmm. you know, in a way, probably people are watching more documentaries or documentary-like
sure.
footage and films than ever before. But when you say character, I mean, people naively
yeah.
might assume,
yeah.
well, what you see in a movie
that's
is
the person.
Yeah, that's
There's no
the person.
Character.
So talk about how
yeah.
you craft a character similar to a
narrative
film.
It's really important
film.
To talk about character in documentary because we are, you know, you're dealing with a real person. So you have a human being with a whole lifetime of experiences, of opinions, of, you know, relationships, of accomplishments, of fears, all this stuff, contradictions. And you have to just be super brutal about like figuring out what tiny sliver of that person are you going to be able to actually represent
right.
in a 90-minute movie?
Yeah.
None, almost none. Right. So you're leaving almost everything out, and you have to really understand, like, in the context of the story that I'm telling, which, like, I would say basically it's like going from a person to a persona.
Right.
Like, which persona is relevant? And you want to be complicated and have, you know, depth, but you also can't share every fact and every, right. you know. So it's just, it's a really important to understand that you are crafting character and you're giving the audience some kind of glimpse at a person, but it's not, it's really important to remember that because these are real people who have to go back and live in the world, like I now have to live in the world, knowing that this representation of myself is out there for people to assume is just true. And it's, of course, it's true, but it's, you know, for example, these themes of loneliness, isolation, the yearning for connection came up quite organically in the film. And in order to heighten that, I cut out all my friends.
Right.
So you watch this film.
Yeah.
And you never see Penny with anyone else.
Right.
Except for her film crew and her, like, surgeons.
And there's and the moments where you're musing, I don't have kids. And
yes.
This and
yes.
That.
So I'm really, and I'm the cat. Yeah. There's a lot of cat shots. So, you know, I'm really pushing the cat lady thing, the childless cat lady thing. All of which is true. I do have a cat. I do
I'm
feel
betting
lonely.
J.D. Vance is probably questionable on altruistic kidney donation.
I'd be curious to know what he thinks about it. But, you know, so it's not that, like, I lied in the movie.
Yeah.
I just, like, didn't show my friends. And I did have footage of friends. It just, like, muddied the thematic, you know? So now I've created this representation of myself, which people are just going to passively inhabit. And they're going to be like, oh, yeah, Penny, she has no friends. So I have to live with that now, Nick, in the world. You know, so when you're doing it to someone else, you need to be ethically aware of that. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're creating a misperception, that person will have to live with it forever. So
Is this a golden age of documentary filmmaking? And I guess maybe to put a finer point on that, I think it is definitely from the point of view of watching documentary films. Is it a golden age of making documentary films?
I would say it depends who you are, what kind of films you want to make. I mean, I'm trying to, like, without sounding pretentious, like, I'm actually trying to create, like, enduring works of art. Mm-hmm. And that takes so much time. It takes money. It takes dedication. It takes all the resources that it takes to do that. And so if what you're trying to do is that, it's, I wouldn't say it's harder to do that than it used to be, but it's not easier.
Right.
But if you are just trying to, like, make a living and, like, which I'm also trying to do, but, you know, if you can make quick, fast, cheap, you know, documentary content, yeah, it's a good time. You know, it's a really good time. People are taking it in, you know, they're passively watching it. It's going in, it's going out. It's just a great era for disposable, quick fix.
So this is kind of like we're in a documentary era that might be similar to, I don't know, when, you know, paperbacks became a technology.
Yeah, maybe.
And, like, you know, you could just, the volume of stuff that was available.
Yeah, the volume's incredible. Bigger. There's no question.
But
I would say it's like, I would say, like, a lot of widgets are being made, but I'm, like, truly not trying to make a widget.
Yeah.
Like, I'm truly trying to make something, like, special. And I know it sounds pretentious, but that's where I'm coming from.
Well, you also, I mean, you have a filmography that speaks to that, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you feel, you know, partly with this wash of not just information, but of narrative constantly being spewed at people, and we're consuming a lot more. Are we better at kind of figuring out, oh, you know what, like, what we're watching, particularly even in the news, much less a documentary, we're looking at characters, and are we mistaking representations of reality for reality? Mm-hmm. Are we getting better at understanding how we might be being played as viewers?
I feel like we're better at it if we want to be, but, like, that's not the average viewing experience. Like, I don't want to think that hard most of the time that I'm watching television.
Right.
So, of course, in theory, we're learning more and more, right? We're more savvy than ever.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean we apply it more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to really be thinking hard to be really looking for the tricks, you know?
Right.
So I think people are more media savvy all the time. And I also think that doesn't mean that we're not still constantly being played.
Yeah.
I feel like I am.
Yeah, no. And sometimes afterwards you appreciate that, right? Because you're like, oh, no, I'm I'm very, if not cynical, I understand all the moves. Yes, and then when you get played, it's
then you really get played.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's when you really get played. I would say also making films, you know, makes me very aware of like what it is you can do to manipulate people. And so I'd like to believe it's made me more of a, you know, active viewer of nonfiction. I think it probably has. But at the same time, you know, I'm also like, it goes against the grain of what is considered normal documentary filmmaking to make films that try to tell the viewer, this isn't everything. Like, you're not going to watch an 80-minute documentary, which is like the amount of content, the information load in that is like not even a magazine article. Like, it is very little information in like an 80-minute film. The idea that you could watch an 80-minute film about like a murder case and believe that you have accurately solved the murder is insane. Like, that makes me crazy.
No, that's at least four episodes.
At least four.
Each 80 minutes long, right?
At least four, yeah.
And I know the Menendez brothers inside and out now, right? Why did you get into documentary filmmaking?
I think it came out of like a couple different things. I really loved going to college and I loved like writing papers. And I discovered that I loved researching and learning and then shaping the results of that process into some kind of communication. And I loved the craft of writing.
But why documentary as opposed to narrative?
Fiction? Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like I liked the real stuff. Like I was writing like papers about factual things, you know, that I was learning about the real world. So I think when I started like playing around with making visual media, and that was the same impulse to understand the world that I live in. And fiction just doesn't have the same challenges. It has very different challenges, and I'm just not that interested in those challenges. I'm very interested, like I was saying before, in like the ethical challenge of making something that's entertaining but still true, you know, that doesn't, you know, sort of mislead people about real things, and but is essentially accurate, but is also artful and is like entertaining. I'm very committed to being entertaining. Yeah. And so that's an interesting challenge. And it's just a different challenge than what you're doing when you have a blank piece of paper and you can just make up anything you want.
Who are your heroes as documentarians?
Certainly early on, like the first film I ever saw that made me want to make documentaries in particular was Exit Through the Gift Shop. That movie was hugely influential on me. It came out in, I think, 2012 or 2011. And I genuinely had never seen such a deep, rich, complicated, intellectual, challenging film that was that funny and was that entertaining. And I was like, oh, that's it. Like, that's the pocket, you know? I love Werner Herzog. I love Errol Morris. I love Agnes Varda. But they're all, like, a little more sophisticated than that in a way. And so I just sort of was like, and also, I never forget because I watched Exit on Netflix, and it was early Netflix days, and they still had reviews. Remember that?
Yeah,
they used to have
reviews,
user reviews.
Yeah.
They've gotten rid of that.
Yeah. That's a shame, actually.
I think it is a shame. So, and I remember looking at the reviews, and I just watched this film and been like, oh my God, it's like so meta, so intellectual. What was real? What was fake? I don't know. You know, I had this really intense, you know, experience, and then like 99% of the viewers were just like, street art's fun. Like, I like street art. And I was like, perfect. Like, that's what I'm aiming for. Like, I really genuinely am. I'm aiming for that. Like, sure, there's like some little snobby audience that's going to appreciate the craft of my film. But I'm hoping that the other 99% of people just like had a good time watching it.
Do you worry that, you know, when I think about documentary, both photography and filmmaking, like, you know, the whole energy comes from it being, no, this is documenting reality.
Yeah.
But so much of it is either fake or fabricated, or, you know, that it's almost totally inauthentic. Morgan Spurlock, who died a few months ago in Supersize Me, you know, there's a famous scene when his liver doctor or whatever, his doctor is like, you know, he's been eating McDonald's for a while. And he says, like, your liver functions are obscene. It's like you're an alcoholic. And like, after the fact, we learned that Morgan Spurlock was an alcoholic. And the reason his liver looked so fucked up was probably because he was drinking, not because he was eating
McDonald's.
Too many Big Macs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes on and on with a lot of other things. Yes. You know, the famous footage of raising the flag at Iwo Jima. You know, there were two raisings because the first one, the flag wasn't
was
big enough. So do it again.
Yeah.
You know, Robert Capa, the great documentary photographer, most of his Spanish Civil War photos were probably staged, Matthew Brady, the Civil War. You know, yeah. You can go on and on. Like, is that an occupational hazard, or is it something the artist as a documentarian should be allowed to do, and then it's on us as viewers to be like, okay, we have to understand what's going on here?
Yeah, I have, like, you know, a lot of feelings about this. One is that obviously artists should be allowed to do whatever they want to do, like, period, the
yeah,
end.
Yeah, of course.
But if you want to use the word documentary and you want to trade on that power and you want to, like, allow that type of, it's a certain cachet, it's a certain ethical kind of standard. You know, you have to just be aware that people are going to expect certain things of that film, and they are going to feel betrayed if they learn that you're fundamentally just lying or bullshitting. That said, I don't lie and bullshit. So just because Morgan Spurlock did it doesn't mean I would. Like,
yeah,
so
well,
I don't want everyone to assume that people are operating with the same playbook. I think that as more and more documentaries get made, people are becoming more and more savvy about the different forms. And I think people are pretty smart. And if you watch, like, a documentary that kind of has a host who's joking and, you know, it's got this kind of, like, you know, slap down. It's like, you know, the Matt Walsh, Am I a Racist movie.
Right.
You know, like, I don't expect it to have the same exact type of journalistic standards as, like, something I'm
watching
on CNN.
As you were talking about ethical, you know, what is considered ethical or not changes for organ donations.
Right.
I remember when Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line came out.
Yes.
People were, like, real
it
film
was not,
aesthetes.
It was not. Okay, so it was
were
not.
Like, oh, he's using reenactments.
In practical terms, he was not eligible for the documentary Oscar because he used reenactments.
Yeah.
So it's quite different now.
It is insane.
Yeah, it's quite
right?
different
and
now.
And I remember in that film, at the end, when one of the main characters, like, lifts his hands to, like, scratch his head, and you realize that the guy is in prison because he's a bad person. I remember thinking, like, that was an incredible move on the audience, like, because it makes you rethink everything in a really powerful way.
Yes, but you can imagine someone else just saying, like,
yeah,
how dare you?
Yeah, manipulated.
Yeah, and I think there's a room for all kinds, and I also think there are bad actors. And I think there are a lot more bad actors in documentary than most people understand. When I
who
got
is,
it,
who's an
I'm not
going to
give you any examples.
No.
But that said, like, once when I got into this field, I truly believed that it was like a community of people who were like truth seekers, you know, and who like, and I mean this in a very deep way, like who genuinely like fetishize the search for truth. And Errol Morris, I think, is one of these people he's willing to say, like, I will go to any length to find the truth and I may not even find it, but that is a noble pursuit. And I was like, that's what I want to do with my life. Then I got into doc and maybe, you know, eventually realize that not everyone's serving that master. I mean, I would say most people in my field are serving a very different master of social justice, of a different type of thing.
So
wanting to hold the powerful accountable, wanting to give voice to the voiceless, which are all valuable things to do, but it's not the same master as, like, I'm going to chase the truth wherever it takes me, you know? So I think we all have to weigh those out. But
is that changing, you know, or has that always been?
I think that's probably always been true. I think I just was, like, a little naive in assuming that we were all the same. Of course we're not all the same.
Right.
People make documentaries for any number of reasons.
Do you have – and I feel like this is a question I shouldn't be asking you after giving a kidney, even if it happened years ago, but the film coming out recently on Netflix. What is your next project?
Oh, gosh. I'm working on a film about Flacco, the owl who escaped Central Park Zoo to have a year of wild living in Manhattan.
It's like his Rumspringa or something, right?
I mean, he was like a real – he lived in a box for 13 years where he couldn't even spread his wings and fly. And then he had a year of freedom where he flew all over Manhattan and had many adventures and sadly died. So I've been covering that story for a really long time. And I'm also wrapping up a new music documentary that's about music for toddlers. So, like, the Wiggles, who are these people? Who are these adults who
is
decide?
Is it the dark side of the Wiggles?
No, it's
the
not.
Sunny side of the Wiggles?
It's the sunny side of the, No, it was, like, the most joyful film. It's really about, like, what kids understand about art that we forget as adults. And it's just so much fun to be in the presence of three-year-old music fans and to see them react so with such purity. And they don't know anything about being cool yet. Like, that's the real – and then watching how – free they are creatively was just super inspiring to me. Maybe want to get back to that, even though I can't because now I'm old and cynical. I know too much.
We're going to leave it there. Penny Lane, thanks for talking to Reason. The new movie, the new documentary is Confessions of a Good Samaritan.
That's right. Thank you, Nick.